Hello and welcome back to the programme with me, Andy Duncan. On today's show, we've got a spectacular, fantastic, a globe-trotting guest. It's Christopher Lingle. There he is. Now, he's a senior fellow with the American Institute of Economic Research, and he's also a visiting professor for innumerable universities around the world. I'll let him tell you about that in a moment. Today's talk, we're going to divide into my usual three kind of areas. So first of all, Christopher's going to let us know who he is, what he does, and so on, specifically talking about his time at AIER and his time during COVID. The second part of the talk today, we're going to be talking about COVID. I know it's the C word. We're going to be talking about scientific authoritarianism and various other topics related around that. And then we'll finish off with what are they going to do to us next? So as the COVID kind of thing tails off, they've probably got other things in mind for the future. What are they going to do and what can we do about it to lessen their response? So let's kick off. Hello, Christopher.
Hello. Greetings from Luxembourg.
You're in Luxembourg. Now, every time I see a post from you on social media, you're in Bangkok or you're in the Spice Islands or you're... can you tell us about all these visiting professorships and about your kind of academic life globe-trotting around the world?
Well, the truth is I'm semi-retired, so I'm not really anywhere doing full-time academic work. Yep. But let's see, on the 1st of May, I left Bangkok. I went into... Romania. I was there for 3 days in three different cities. I went from there to Albania, Slovenia, Croatia, Serbia, did I say? And then now I'm in Luxembourg. So that was a whirlwind tour hosted and organized by the Austrian Economic Center in Vienna under the under Barbara Combs, very able hand. The Free Market Roadshow, as it's known, is this year was in 45 cities around Europe, and I think in five cities in the U.S. this year, I think for the first time. So that's been a great opportunity for me to meet people in this particular year, and mostly in the Balkans, a lot of young people, young professionals, to talk about the importance of human liberty. Interestingly, I spoke for the most part about COVID-19 pandemic policies and a bit about entrepreneurship. And my position with the AIER, the American Institute for Economic Research in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, is a temporary one at their discretion. They've invited me. This will be the third summer I've been there for a research fellowship. So I don't have a permanent posting there, but I've been lucky enough to be allowed back. and my academic and spiritual home is in Guatemala at Universidad Francisco Marroquín. I've been going there since 1998. When I actually began my sort of retirement years, and I've simply been taking opportunities when they were presented to me to go to other places.
You sort of have the life I kind of dreamed of. I'd kind of like to have been you in a way. If I'd done an economics degree and then become a professor of economics or something, but my life didn't go that way. But yeah. I wish it had in some ways. Listening to all of that. I don't know how you keep up with all the different time zones you're in. You travel even more than me, and I thought I travel too much. But where did you get stuck during COVID? Where were you when it was all going on?
Well, I left Bali on my way to, I thought, India and Nepal, where I had some things set up in early 2020. And then from there, I was going to go back with the Free Market Roadshow. First stop was Albania, I think, so on. And when I landed in Bangkok, the news came out that India had shut down its borders. So I said, well, I was in Bangkok. And I thought, well, I think I'll go over to Phuket. I had some friends there. It was an island, and it would be all over in a couple of weeks' time. I had no...
Just two weeks to flatten the surfing curve.
Yeah, I had no imagination that the extent of the repression and the acceptance of the repression that we went through over the last 3 years. I mean, it's still stunning to me. I remember back in March of 2020, when the Japanese were talking about suspending or you know, their uncertainty about the Olympics. And I said, well, that's July. I mean, this is an absurdity. There's no way that an event like that, with so many years of planning and so on, would have some sort of problems. But little did we know.
And the way they snuck it up on us as well, wasn't it? 2 weeks to flatten the curve, and then we're just going to start this little lockdown thing going on. And then it just became ridiculous and ridiculous. But one person they seem to turn to, because whenever the state sees an opportunity, it tends to grab whichever educationalist, technocrat has the worst possible story. So they turn to Niall Ferguson, because... He's the fool who said that there'd be 50,000 deaths in the UK from BSA. There was 177. He's the fool the British government used to burn £10 billion, killing 6 million healthy animals during a swine flu fever. But they turned to him rather than animals, because he was always the most extreme on anything. And he broke his own lockdown rules as well with his girlfriend visiting her, which is nice. Can you tell us about this scientific authoritarianism that always seems to happen in these cases, where they grab scientists whose views chime in with their own and then extend it? What are your thoughts on scientific authoritarianism?
Well, you know, it would be tempting to think of all of this as a conspiracy, but most of the people involved are not smart enough to have conceived of what happened. I think I turn to public choice economics to try to understand this. I think what that tells us is that political leaders and maybe bureaucrats, health bureaucrats perhaps, would rather be accused or guilty of doing too much than being accused of doing too little. So there's a tendency. And I think that may explain why they would turn to someone like Niall Ferguson. Now, I hate to be fair to the guy, because he really is, you know, at the heart of a lot of problems here. But what happened is that choosing to ignore the big picture, so to speak. I mean, Niall Ferguson, he's an epidemiologist. He has a narrow focus. And it was up to the politicians to accept that narrow focus and ignore all other aspects of life. It was only one virus. There's many millions or trillions of viruses. It's only one illness among many types of illnesses. And it's only one aspect of life. Of course, health is very important, but there are many other things in life. But we ignored every other aspect. And again, the inclination or the sort of reward system, the incentives are for politicians to take that somewhat extreme view, because they would rather be accused of saying, you know, you didn't do enough, you killed my grandmother, as opposed to we did all we could and we're really sorry your grandmother died. And that's a different sort of interaction between people. You know, you could see what we did, and it still didn't stop her death. So this is, again, I hate to be fair to these people, but this is kind of a built-in tendency we should understand. But that's why we should resist it even more. So that's what we were stuck with. And then, of course, as they were casting about, Niall Ferguson was bad enough, but they said, well, where is this happening? Well, China. So they instead of saying, we never want to follow an autocratic, one-party state, the policies they, you know, that they concoct, they followed China almost to a T. I mean, the Chinese propaganda was very effective. I'm sure you remember people supposedly dropping dead on the street from this respiratory illness. I mean, it's completely absurd, but no one questioned it. It reminded me of many years ago, there was some jury trials concerning the impact of Agent Orange. And one of the people who was trying to receive compensation said that that when he made love with his wife, that the sperm would give her second and third degree burns. Well, you know, body heat is very limited. There's no way that it ever gets to those kind of temperatures. But this was accepted by journalists in particular that had no curiosity. They just went, wow, let's report that. That's news, instead of, that's dubious. So this is what happened, I think, in this instance. And I'm sure you remember, as the viewers will, these inert bodies that were being carted away from hospitals or nursing homes with people wearing hazmat suits. Now, this was a respiratory virus. Corpses do not respirate. This image, I mean, again, it was really orchestrated well. The Chinese started it, and we followed it. You may have also seen there were these images of vehicles and these wide boulevards in China moving in with martial music in the background, spraying some substance into the air to kill, to do what? These are absurdities, but they were not challenged by the media or by an uncurious public. And this is really what happened. It's partly the fault of the experts, but it's our fault that we weren't curious enough to challenge these. I had been living in Asia when the first SARS coronavirus came out. You remember, this is SARS coronavirus 2. It's not one. It's not novel. It's not unknown. It was something there before. And there was lots written about it. It was much more deadly, much less contagious, happily. It disappeared. But it had certain attributes that were knowable and could have been discussed, but they weren't. I mean, people said, no, this is a novel virus. We don't know. And they played that game and people went along with it. I was having nothing better to do. I started reading medical journals about this and, you know, news reports at that time. I wanted to know what epidemiologists did, how they did it. So I began looking into all these things. But I had time on my hands. I was never, you know, I was ignorant in a way, but informed enough never to be afraid of this particular virus, even though I'm in the demographic profile that was most affected. The frail and aged.
Well, I wouldn't exactly describe you as that. Now, it seemed to take everybody, didn't it? So Boris Johnson, perhaps the most libertarian prime minister in the UK, debatedly in the last 50 years. Trump in the US, again, debatedly, probably the most libertarian president of the United States for 50 years, before Ronald Reagan, who was still a statist. Yeah. But they got rolled over by the technocracy and their civil service and everything. There was talk of China flying propagandists to Italy, and people like Neil Ferguson, very narrow-minded Neil Ferguson, was waiting to lock down the country, but didn't feel he could do it. So he said, we need someone else to do it first who's not China. And then Italy locked itself down, and then Neil Ferguson and all the acolytes around Whitehall who followed him then went, yes! Then they locked down the UK 2 weeks to flatten the curve. That lasted 2 years. But one country resisted. One country resisted, Sweden. Now, according to Neil Ferguson and other experts, perhaps everyone in Sweden should have died because they weren't as extreme as lockdown Chinese fascist communist policies, people dropping dead on the streets. And even in Sweden, the politicians were trying to introduce lockdown. Even the king was complaining about not having a lockdown, but the law was clear. It came down to the government department that was in charge, and they had complete control to stop panic. And so they said, no, we don't need all this stuff. We're just going to do this this much, much, much looser policy. How did Sweden, do you think, resist the push towards lockdowns? Why didn't everyone die in Sweden? And has the world learned the lesson of Sweden that the world didn't need to do this? Or will it just all be forgotten the next time this happens?
Well, I think that there's a selective amnesia or trying to ignore what happened in Sweden. Now, again, Tegnell himself said that it wasn't so much his own decision, but it was the constraints, the legal, the constitutional constraints. They didn't have the power to do it. But he did raise the question. You know, one thing is, if you go into lockdown, how do you get out of it? It's like the Hotel California. You can check out, but you can't leave. And he realized this, and I think he was willing to take the public heat, partly because he didn't have the legal capacity to declare it. So maybe he was lucky in that regard. I mean, he might even say that himself. Another interesting example is Nicaragua. Nobody speaks about Nicaragua. Now, here's a poor country. They were too poor to buy the tests. You know, they were too poor to buy the vaccines, and whoops, they didn't all die. the record of Nicaragua, or I'm sure we can find other places in Africa much the same. These aren't discussed. It's always like, oh, we're you know, the problem with much of the West were these many people died from the ventilators. You know, the chosen protocol that became an obsessive protocol that was blowing out the lungs of these elderly people. And it's, I've read, I have a headline, an article in which they suggest that almost most of the elderly deaths came from ventilators. And you didn't have ventilators in Nicaragua or most of Africa. They relied upon existing or repurposed pharmaceuticals that were at hand. And meanwhile, in the West, in order to support the lockdown mentality and the pandemic policies, they had to discredit any alternative protocol, whether it was hydrochloroquine or ivermectin or zinc or vitamin D. And it's partly in the United States, there's a requirement in order to give an emergency use authorization to any sort of treatment. There cannot be any other alternatives. So that's why they had to discredit these things. Now, they may have been justified on medical and scientific grounds. It might have been. I'm not sure it was. But what made it necessary to discredit these other protocols was this requirement. If you have any other possible treatment, so this is the only way to get vaccines mainstreamed. You had to discredit these other protocols. And they did a very effective job of it. Horse dewormers a nightly news disparagement of ivermectin, one of the safest drugs, cheapest. It was never even patented. It's been used by millions of people, billions of times. So all of a sudden, this was a dangerous thing. No, it wasn't dangerous. It was dangerous to this obsession with vaccines. The interesting thing about, and again, I follow this very closely, the only way a pharmaceutical company can declare its drug or its vaccine to be safe and effective, these are two operative words, is once they pass the phase 3 trials and then they are approved. Now, so if Pfizer had said before the approvals, had said they're safe and effective, they would have been punished. But politicians could say it. They weren't saying it on So this is what was happening. These operative terms that can only be used by the producers to avoid legal or sanctions or whatever, politicians happily and irresponsibly, maybe they didn't know, maybe they didn't care, but they kept telling us that they're safe and effective, they're safe and effective. And this really, another problem that I saw through this development is that we were being given false information and even contradictory information. But the citizens were uncurious. We had journalists that became stenographers rather than investigators. And they simply parroted the pandemic policy narrative. And this is really one of the most disappointing periods of my entire life. I mean, the erosion of, I think, human liberty, but also we've seen a destruction of social trust that comes from market transactions. It took us centuries of using the market where we began to see other human beings as people that could help us solve problems. And overnight, other people became potential carriers of dangerous pathogens. So we saw an atomization of humanity. We began driving people apart, social isolation, whatever you want to call it, lockdowns, quarantines, blah, blah, blah. Now, one of the complaints of Marxism against liberalism, classical liberalism, is the so-called atomistic individual, this sort of isolated, which was always a nonsense. But here we have government policies that are, in principle, supposed to be helping or preserving the collective, but in doing so, dividing us, making us into these atomistic individuals that never existed under liberalism, because under classical liberalism and the market process, the market order, we need each other. It's the most socializing instrument or institutional arrangement that we've ever depended upon, the market, that is, because we need each other. We need to cooperate with each other to get our daily bread, to have our needs fulfilled. And in what we saw is that even Jeffrey Tucker has a very interesting article that just came out in the Epoch Times. I've never seen that particular website, in which he, without naming names, points to the fact that many libertarians, so supposedly profound thinkers about the necessity and the advantages of human liberty, coming out in support of these terrible pandemic policies. It's very, very interesting. These are the same complaints I made less vocally before. I mean, COVID-19 policies, pandemic policies, divided the libertarians in much the way that Trump did. There were many libertarians that were full-on supporters of Donald Trump. Meanwhile, others were much more reticent at the very least. Same with COVID-19 policies. There were these bogus arguments about, this is an issue of externalities, and if you're not vaccinated, it's an aggression against others. I don't know whether they were individually afraid for their own health, or maybe their parents, they're worried about their children or their grandparents. But they were so engaged with trying to find an argument, I mean, really against human liberty, rather than saying, look, let's do a litmus test on this. What is this going to do if we go along with mandatory testing or mandatory vaccines or lockdowns? And it's really stunning that we had this sort of retreat from something that you would have thought would be bedrock principles for these people. So that's something I think other people should read. Of course, Jeff Tucker is one of the facilitators for the Great Barrington Declaration, which was declaring that, again, they observed what I observed, that the first COVID killed mostly elderly people and immunocompromised. So let's protect them. And, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer. So why should we shut down the entire community when there's a fairly narrow demographic that is really most threatened, and do your best to protect them? Of course, the tragedy of viruses don't care about public policy. Viruses have their own logic. And they're going to seek us out. They're going to seek out those weaknesses. And they'll be probing constantly. So it doesn't matter if you're an island nation like New Zealand or a continent like Australia. You can run, but you can't hide. It's going to come back to haunt you. I think we were failed by the libertarian elite, which is what Jeff Tucker suggests there. And I think he's right.
Yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes to Jeff's article there, which sounds very, very interesting. I haven't read that myself. Now, I'm a bit like you in that I believe much more in a cock-up theory of history rather than conspiracy theory. Yeah. But on top of this herd mentality of ignorant politicians just doing what they were told to avoid being unelected later, which might be your picture that you've painted so far, there has been a kind of a conspiracy going on. So I'm just giving some examples. The IMF giving grants to government, big grants to governments who impose lockdowns and so on. Bill Gates and his obsession with injecting people all around the world for whatever reason. The WEF and their great reset ideas. And they've got fingers in every pie in the world, including, of course, Twitter. Sure. They just got the new CEO of Twitter, which is a terrible shame. Do you think that these shadowy Bond villain kind of figures in the background, like Klaus Schwab, were trying to impose this in order to get towards their one world government that they dream of in the future?
I think it was somewhat opportunistic. Certainly Schwab was, you know, waiting for some event like this. But an American politician, Rahm Emanuel, made a famous quote, "Never let a good crisis go to waste." Yeah. You know, it means that governments will be able to do what they wanted to do anyway, but felt constrained. And Hayek preceded that by saying, you know, emergencies or crises or have always been used as a way of repressing human liberty. So we had these warnings that we should have been alert to. Now, I have a kind of a pop theory on this that Bill Gates, I think he did do, he's been trying to oversee and funding investigations for a vaccine against malaria. Now, that's a nice way to spend your philanthropic money. But I think what happened with Gates, he said, I've got this vaccines and I need a problem. Ah, COVID. So he had a solution, but he needed a problem and COVID presented itself. So he went full on this. And again, the early sort of motivations were perhaps more pure in a sense. I don't think he was necessarily, and people suggested he's a has an image of some finding something to lower population or population growth. I don't think that's good. Now, there was another thing. There was a problem that needed a solution. So Bill Gates had a solution, vaccine. It needed a problem, COVID. And then there was another problem, Donald Trump. It needed a solution, COVID. Well, because Donald Trump would have been reelected in a landslide. The economy was doing reasonably well, or better, and minorities were faring quite well under the economic times prior to this COVID incident. So it's really interesting how those things unfolded. Now, I don't know that that there was a global sort of conspiracy, whatever, to get rid of Donald Trump, but it was certainly, so COVID satisfied many different, or the pandemic satisfied many different needs or whatever from different perspectives. I also worry about the reach of the World Economic Forum into so many. I mean, they've been so triumphalist about declaring that they have people in almost every Western liberal democracy everywhere in the world. This is something, again, where are the journalists of my generation that would have said, that's got a bad smell to it? Do we really want, I mean, if we said we have libertarians at high levels of every government, there would be an inquiry into that. But there's not any. I mean, but it's partly because they're all on the same page. And unfortunately, the main feature on that page, which everyone is reading, is the climate crisis. And this is, I think, it may be in a way an accidental way of getting there. But the pandemic policies were a trial run, a dress rehearsal, I fear, for what is really out there. Look, this was only one illness that maybe some of you might have died from. And you accepted all of these repressions. But climate action is something that will save us all because we will all be wiped out. Humanity is an existential crisis. If we do not act now to ban carbon-based fuel consumption, we're all going to die. So I really fear that this is, and it will be compelling in the same way that, in a different way than the COVID-19. They will say, look around you. There's evidence. I mean, even though there's contradictory evidence, but they use everything that happens is based upon climate change. It doesn't matter if you're talking about increased income disparities, social inequalities, racism. This is, I mean, it's unbelievable what is, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's to the point of absurdity in a way that climate change is the source of every bad thing that happens in our lives. And again, we have a media that that reports this without challenging it. And the propaganda, the brainwashing, the influencing of the earlier generations to my own has been very effective in that regard. And that to me is very troubling.
Yeah, the thing with global warming or climate change or whatever is when I was a young boy about 5 years ago, we were taught that we were in an interglacial. I was in a normal state school, and we were told in geography lessons that we're in an interglacial. We're probably going into an ice age. There'll be some ups and downs. It was very warm about 8,000 years ago, the Holocene maximum. There was the Minoan warming. It got very warm during the Roman times. It got very cold in about 1500, 1600, the Little Ice Age. It's probably going to get warmer now, but it'll get colder. Eventually, we'll end up in another glaciation. And that was just standard teaching in state schools, of all places. Sure. We've seen the state get rid of all that. I don't think you'll find a state school in England that teaches that anymore. They ignore the Great
Barrier Reef. That it was taught. They don't even teach that it was taught.
Yeah. they completely ignored the Great Barrington Declaration, which again was something to do with the AIER. Now, they only fund scientists who are telling the messages that they want, and they absolutely destroy any scientists who ever dare to say anything against the narrative. But do you think people will accept these things? So during COVID, you could say, well, I don't want to kill my grandmother. Yeah. So although I know wearing a mask is a complete waste of time and will probably give me lung diseases, I'll put up with it because I don't want my grandmother or other people's grandmothers to die. But will people accept you can't get on this plane today because you've used up your air miles? The people who go on private jets to Davos have decided that you only have 2,000 flight points a year and you've used them up, so you can't get on a plane. Or you can't have that red meat because you've used up your cow points and you must eat the soy sausage rubbish. Will people, we've seen some resistance to the COVID stuff. So in Austria, they were going to make it mandatory to get stuck with these injections, with these things that give you heart disease. Yeah. But the people in Austria, it was a very small core, 1-2% said, no, we are not doing this. Lock us up. We're not going to do this. And we saw resistance in Australia and New Zealand eventually to their draconian policies. And we've seen their politicians all got rid of it. Probably could have been better in Canada, but somehow Trudeau survived all of that. We did see some resistance to COVID, even in the Anglophone Western countries. Do you think we'll see much more resistance to impositions because of environmentalism?
No, I'm afraid not. And, you know, I engage a number of pop theories that are just things that come into my head at times. Many of the CEOs that are supporting woke policies for whatever particular outcome, which could include global warming, whether we look at the inanities of these diversity, what do they call diversity, equality, and inclusion, or worrying about the carbon footprint of a corporation. I really think to a large degree, these CEOs are responding to the reactions of their children and their spouses. Now, you imagine a lot of these CEOs, the male ones, their wives go off to a book club, and the book club is reading some nonsensical book about the destruction of humanity. And they come home and they accuse the husband of that. Or the children come home from school. Daddy, my teacher said you're destroying the planet. So how do you resist that? I mean, even if you're a smart guy, a smart person, how do you resist that? So the immediate, you know, sort of attitudes that are being expressed around you at the dinner table or during vacation or holidays are driving you Either you have to have a very forceful personality to withstand those onslaughts or to respond to them, to dampen them or to correct them, or you give in. Now, of course, meanwhile, those people are going, they're getting MBAs at universities where a lot of this nonsense is being provided to them. So they feel, so even if they are smart people, they've been inundated from the educational establishment if they've got MBAs from the top universities. So I think it's going to be very, very difficult for us to escape all of this because the we've got the media that have bought into it completely. The people in the media are no longer educated in the classics, history, or they don't have background in political science or certainly none in economics. They have background in journalism. They study journalism. They study the history of journalism, not history. They find out about the heroic journalists that are war journalists or whatever. But they are primarily activists. That is, they go into their profession with an intent to find ways to use the state to solve human problems. So there's a bias built in that. And I think we're living with that that development where I can promise you without, well, I could be wrong. I haven't done the empirics on this, but if you go to a journalism school curriculum, you won't find economics there. They might take a softer social science that will be much less likely to challenge their priors. So I think we're being set up here. And again, we failed the first test with COVID. The libertarian elite, many of them failed the first test of COVID. I think it's going to be very difficult for us to because the forces arraigned against us or in favor of the kind of climate action to address the climate crisis, it's going to be almost irresistible. And I'm pessimistic for the first time in my life in that regard, because what I know about public choice economics combined with what I feel like I've learned about how the dynamics of learning and the sort of motivations of journalists and what we've seen is happening in these corporate headquarters. The larger corporations are the ones that are the most outspoken in favor of these repressions. And so, and these are well-respected people. They're very wealthy and influential. We have to be really alert. I mean, if we're going to avert this, we need to redouble our efforts.
Yeah, well, I've spoken to quite a number of libertarians in the last few months on this podcast, and they're all giving me the same story. I keep wanting to get on a barricade and throw rocks at the enemy, and they're saying, no, it's all over. So if I can just ask you to be slightly optimistic, is there anything that we can do to slow down this oncoming tide of this panopticon one world state that is going to be very difficult to escape from? Is there anything that we can do? What should we be doing to try to minimize this and one day hope that the tide can be reversed?
Well, I think, you know, it's funny. I'm rather like a carpenter who only has a hammer. So I see everything as a nail in the sense that economic growth solves a lot of problems. It solves poverty, obviously. Economic growth, I believe, solves inequality, income, wealth inequality. In the sense of remove, I mean, the real concern to me is not income or wealth inequality, it's poverty. I don't really care where the inequality goes in terms of the breadth or whatever. But I think if, and one can be optimistic, if governments were to allow entrepreneurs more free rein, that is through deregulation or curbing their appetite for higher tax rates or more taxes. I think the distractions from enjoying life under a vibrant economy would make it more difficult for people to be turned towards accepting these kind of repressions. But this is what's convenient about these lockdowns, is that they made people somewhat miserable economically, uncertain about their future. So they were more willing to turn to the state for an answer. I think if we go back to days where we had a more free and open access to economic growth and development, I think this would make it more difficult to have the kind of impositions I think are in store for us otherwise. So now I'm pessimistic about whether politicians are going to do this. I mean, even if Boris Johnson had somehow survived, I mean, Liz had some libertarian ideas and she lasted, what, about 45 minutes. People were not ready to listen to her proposals. And unfortunately in the U.S., I don't think Trump has a clear vision of anything really, other than satisfying his own ego. He did do some, maybe by accident, some good things, or at least he had spoken in favor of some good things. But on the other side, the Democrats have been doing everything consistently wrong, I believe, in terms of moving the country, the U.S. in particular, towards a more entrepreneurial-driven economy. And until we somehow recuperate that, I mean, there was, you know, what I think social media and the development of the internet began to make entrepreneurship more achievable for many people, because we moved from a situation where physical capital was very important. You had to build big factories and you had to take large risks of capital for long periods of time. And then these rewards, you know, were perhaps even to other people justified. And now a lot of the wealth creation is through human capital. You know, some kid sitting in the basement, coming up with an app and overnight becoming a millionaire. And so entrepreneurship became, well, it seemed to be more accessible, more available, and more respectable. But now we're beginning to lose that. Again, the sort of the glorification of the state actor who's spending other people's money on other people. Somehow that has become an idealized public figure. And until we recuperate this sort of idea that the entrepreneur is really the source of not only economic progress, but social progress, I think that's the road ahead is much more difficult until we get there. We've got to understand that entrepreneurs within a market-based logic, without state privileges, without state-granted monopolies, without state protections, this is the way that we need to move forward. And if we are to get there, we will ignore the entreaties, the demands of the talking heads and the political forces. We can say, look, we can live without you. We're doing very well, thank you. And you just go on and we'll leave you in the background, which is where the state should be. It should be sort of just background noise that sometimes needs to be quieted down. But unfortunately, the news media corporations have put the state in the foreground and they've become the dominant force rather than entrepreneurs.
Yeah, and that can happen quickly. I was in the Philippines when the COVID stuff started. And before that point, I didn't even know the Philippines government existed. Just didn't exist. I was living in a private city that was guarded by private security guards, and I didn't need to interact with the state at all. And with COVID, they went from nothing, because mayors in the Philippines have enormous power. We went from no government visibility at all to enormous roadblocks, soldiers with guns saying, you cannot leave this area, within about 3 weeks. It was absolutely incredible how fast these weeds of humanity can progress. to my mind, I'm hoping that machine learning will be the entrepreneurial, you know, social media there has made it easier, brought the bar down. I'm hoping machine learning, if enough people learn how to use it and do it, will be another bar lowering thing. Now, I think we've covered a lot of ground there. Did we miss anything today that you'd like to talk about before we wrap up?
I have a bit of a cold and my brain doesn't work as well. Let me try.
The COVID virus, of course, has evolved into just another cold virus.
Yeah. Well, I think what happened is I went from 34 degrees in Bangkok to, you know, 8 degrees in Iași, Romania. So anyway, I've kind of got a chill. I think, again, my primary concern is what I've just expressed, is that we've got to have this sort of revival of an understanding that entrepreneurs, not politicians, not bureaucrats, are what move us forward, not only materially, but also in terms of our social interactions and so on. I had another thing coming in the back of my mind, and it slipped away as I was speaking. Let me think, what did I want to talk about? My head's a bit cloudy this morning. Sorry.
No worries, because you move around the world so much. I'm surprised that your body clock has kept you awake this long. Now, that was all fascinating to listen to, and we covered a lot of areas. Where's the best place where people can get hold of you to book you for speeches and lectures and so on, or just to contact you to say hello?
Well, on social media somehow, but I keep an email through the Francisco Marroquin, so I can be reached there. But I don't have any. I no longer have a website. I used to do some consulting, and I no longer do that. I give sort of invited talks, like we did with the Free Market Roadshow, but. I'm on Facebook, of course, Instagram, and all the usual suspects, so I can be tracked down. And I'm sure I am tracked down somewhat, as you must be observed by the Stasi of our days, whoever that might be. But I think one thing I would like to end on is to try to inject some optimism. I think when you have the better arguments, which is, when the evidence that your arguments are better, whether we're looking at the disasters of experiments with communism or socialism, state socialism, whatever we want to reflect on, I think we should realize that what we need to do is do our best to convince more people of this through these kind of podcasts, broadcasts, as you're doing, and I commend you for that. Many of my friends are doing similar things. So we have the opportunity that was not there when I was quite young to have a wider reach, quite costlessly in many ways. If people are curious, they'll find this particular broadcast and hopefully find something useful. So I think we could be more optimistic. And I think in doing so, we just have to keep moving forward, and I applaud your efforts, and I hope you'll gain a wider audience.
Well, thank you for that. I have allowed the use of the V word today, and I'm just hoping that YouTube's Google algorithm doesn't pick me up and take this video off. But we do have Rumble videos, and we've got the podcast, so hopefully the message will get out. I do love your background back there, the picture on the wall behind you. So that just remains for me then. Thank you very much for your time today, Christopher. It's been fascinating to listen to your thoughts on all of this. And I'd like to thank the viewers who've reached this far. I'd like to thank you for watching so far today. So again, Christopher, thank you very much. And to everyone else, I'll see you next time.
Great. Thanks so much. Ciao.